I'm going to be brief today. A novel thing, you might think. This is a parable that draws out two reactions from me every time I read it. On one hand, I like it. I like it because there's something about this smart, seemingly devious steward that kind of sticks it a little bit to the big guy. Kind of partial to that. What I don't like about the parable, though, is its capacity to penetrate beyond my defenses and seeming nobility and to challenge me and confront me, and I think all of us seeking to be faithful, with how we really put, in terms of ministry and priorities of God's kingdom, our money where our mouths are. So it's uneasy, even at the same time as it is intriguing. What are we going to do? Let me try to give a little bit of background of the text and then invite us to reflect a little bit on it. First, to begin with this story. This past week, one of our children's friends, actually Lorena, had a friend who had won a ticket for lunch with Wade Redden. And that took place on Friday and very graciously invited our children. So they went off to the Empire Grill down in the market to meet with Wade Redden, the hockey player for the Ottawa Senators. And I went to pick up the kids and got a chance to meet Wade and talk with him. And what is very interesting is that there's a story that was shared with me about him by my colleague, Jim Baldwin, who's the minister at Britannia United Church, with whom I was ordained the very same day at the same service. And Wade tells me that after ordination, he was settled in Saskatchewan, the small town where Wade is from, as I was settled in the south shore of Montreal. And he tells me the story, when I moved to Ottawa a few years ago, that Wade had been in the Sunday school of the church that one of the churches he was pastoring. And he reached a certain age where he started disappearing and not being there on Sunday mornings, and he would see him and say, "What's happening?" He says, "Well, I've got hockey. You know, I've got to be playing hockey." And so Jim said to him, "Well, you know, church, really, when you think about it, and Sunday school, that's a little bit more important, you know. That hockey stuff you're doing, it's not going to lead anywhere." And I was reminding Wade about this story, and he chuckled and had a quick laugh about that. But I say that story and just park that in your mind as we think about our parable today. Rich man, maybe an absentee landlord. Somebody in the same place, we're not sure, but it was very customary in those days where absentee landlords who own vast amounts of land would entrust certain people to look after it for them. And what they had to do was to ensure that it was maximized in terms of rent, in terms of payment, in terms of every acreage being used. So that was their job. Some report has come to this owner that this manager is either lazy or something's gone wrong, he's not maximizing his profits, and that was the terms of his job. And so he's hauled before the owner, and he is summarily dismissed. Now, the fact that the story does not include any kind of protestation might suggest that that accusation is correct. And then the manager goes into a little soliloquy. He starts to talk to himself. He says, "Gee, my goodness, what am I going to do? I'm not strong. I don't want to dig and do any hard manual labor. Look at these hands. Look at my manicure. I'm too ashamed to go and beg. I mean, I'm a proud person. What am I going to do?" He thinks to himself, ponders, and he comes up with a plan. Before word gets out that he's been fired, he goes and he calls some of the big debtors to the owner, sends out his servants to go and get them. Now, they have some means because they owe a lot, so it means that they're kind of operating a big operation. However, they're also at threat for famine, failure of crops, and that sorts of thing. So anyway, they come, assuming that he's still acting as a legal representative of the owner. And he tells me, he says, "Well, how much do you owe?" "Well, a lot of oil. A whole bunch of oil. 400 gallons of oil." He says, "Okay, cut that in half. We'll write it up. We'll change the bill. Quick, quick." Notice he's asking them to hurry up, suggesting that he wants to do it before he's discovered. "What are you? What do you owe?" "Wheat, 100 bushels. Cut that to 80. Give it 20% off." "Okay." Off he goes. Then he takes the books to his owner. And his owner realizes what he has done and what's happened. You see, we have to understand the mentality of the Middle East. In the village and the owner, reputation was everything. And because reputation was so important, he knew that this manager had him over the barrel. Because what he could do is say, call those people back and reinstate the original amount. But by now, you can imagine, especially the one who's got his bill cut in half, he's gone home, he's told his family, he's told his friends, they're partying, the wine is flowing, and the village is having a great time. If he were to go and interrupt that, he would be scandalized in their eyes. And so he realizes that what the manager has done with astuteness, with cleverness, with shrewdness, is force his hand and cause him to acquiesce in a sense. Now we have to say, is Jesus condoning either dishonesty? Is Jesus condoning the cleverness of this person? What is it that Jesus is saying? You need to look at what this person is doing to the disciples. What can we ask and discern from this? I want to suggest to you, for our reflection, it is not unlike Jesus to point to seemingly scandalous analogies for God and himself in order to make a point. You remember in John's Gospel, he says, the Son of Man, or I come like a thief in the night. Is he condoning thievery and people who break in and home invasions? No, but the suddenness of the way in which Jesus comes upon us. He compares God to a judge who has to be harassed by a widow for justice. Is God that kind of hard-ears person who is unmoved by people's requests and seeking to do injustice? No. But the teaching there, is the image of God we're given, is that God can be moved in our request. So there is a small point to be made when comparisons are made with seemingly ignoble characters. So what is the point here? I would suggest to you that what Luke is trying to help us appreciate by the commentary that follows and putting the sayings of Jesus is asking us to ask ourselves, if this particular steward who doesn't have the consciousness or the awareness that some greater impending crisis, such as the transformation of the world that God intends, can be clever with his own limited understanding. In other words, he is looking at the crisis of his own survival. His own survival. How am I going to ingratiate myself to those after they find out that I am no longer employed? How am I going to get in their good books? And he becomes very clever in being able to do that. And Jesus is saying to you, the disciples, because this is being addressed to the disciples, how much more the crisis of my good news, announcing God's intention that the world be turned upside down in its values, that the poor somehow receive what they need, that the lame are able to walk, that the structures that oppress people are dashed away, and that lives are transformed and they are turned to worship of God. That's a crisis in every era. How much more are you to be clever, shrewd, intelligent, steadfast in being able to secure that future? Not your own selfish future, but the future that God intends. We can't escape that the main subject is around how do we manage our money, our property, our possessions. You ever see these ads on the television all the time? Make your money work for you. Make yourself wealthy, not somebody else. Put yourself in the driver's seat. Love all these slogans, you know. I think those companies would love this parable. What Jesus is saying, I believe, how are we going to be intelligent, shrewd, focused, and committed in organizing our lives and our resources to accomplish God's vision for the world? What am I going to do in that? Story is told about Robert Smith. He was out for a long walk. He's recovering from a massive heart attack. While he's out, his wife receives a telephone call from the Reader's Digest Association sweepstakes announcing that he has just won $1,500,000.
She's so excited. Oh, this is great. Until she stops to think, oh, I better not tell Robert because it might give him another heart attack. He'll be so shocked with the news. What should I do? So she decides to call her minister, says, I have a problem. Pastor Williams, I have a problem. We've just won some money. I'm afraid to tell Bob because it might give him another heart attack and he'll drop dead. I know you are accustomed to breaking news to people in very gentle ways, so I'm asking for your wisdom. So I think I can help. I'll be over in an hour. So Pastor Williams comes over. Bob has come back from his walk and they sit down. And he says, Bob, I need you to help me with something. A theoretical situation. Suppose somebody in the church were to win $1,500,000. How do you think I should tell them about that? Like, say you, for instance, suppose you did, like, what would you do? And Bob said, oh, that's easy. I'd give $750,000 to the church for the ministry of God. Whereupon, Pastor Williams had a heart attack and dropped dead. I think the parable is inviting us to realize that Jesus expects, he is not surprised by the possibility of generosity, of shrewdness, and the capacity to manage the things we have for the purposes of God, for the glory of God, to give as we have never dreamed of giving because we have been apprehended and grasped by the urgency of God's desire for the world, of our transformation, of the world's transformation. And we know that the things that are really important to us, the really important to us, are meant to be used for God. Now, let me just conclude with this connection. It seems as if many of us think that the small acts that we do don't matter in the large picture. Most of us this coming week are not going to dine with the Queen, not going to be invited to the PMO's office, maybe some will, not going to convert a nation, not going to stop a war, not going to christen a ship, not going to do any grandiose things perhaps. But what we will have the opportunity to do is to pray for someone, to send a card to someone who is lonely, to tell a story to a child, to mow your neighbor's lawn, take their dog for a walk because they've been sick for a week. Teach Sunday school. Serve on a committee at church. Those small acts, if you're faithful with a little, you will be given more. We don't have to look for the grandiose scheme. We have to be shrewd in organizing our lives in small ways in order that all at our disposal may benefit from our rehearsing the capacity to serve God with all we are and all we have. So let me ask you this. Think about your own life. Think about what's really important to you. Think about the small things that you have at your disposal this week to do. The people in your heart, in your circle of influence, the job or the friends or the duties and responsibilities. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? If we keep in mind the crisis that Jesus announces, that God's judgment is coming on those who have absolute dispassionate regard for the needy, those who have no regard for what is the dream of God, that God's love and strength is coming for those who are seeking to do something about that, what are you going to do? What will you do? What will I do?